As all of you know, over the past year, important new regulatory initiatives have been advanced at both the national and international level. These include, of course, the recent agreement in Basel for stronger capital and liquidity standards and for internationally active banks, and the considerable regulatory changes that have been embodied in the Dodd-Frank Act. Today, I want to discuss some of these initiatives with a special focus on the recent agreement in Basel on capital and liquidity for large internationally active banks. I will give you my perspective on how these efforts have been informed by the lessons of the financial crisis and discuss what I think some of the likely consequences may be as these measures are put in place. Given the breadth of the changes and the limited time that I have to speak, my remarks will be by no means complete. And as always, my remarks reflect my own views and not necessarily those of the Federal Reserve System. The biggest lesson of the financial crisis, I think, is that severe financial disruptions can inflict very large and persistent costs on real economic activity and employment. Thus, lawmakers and regulators must make widespread changes to create a more resilient and global financial system. But at the same time, this must be done in a way that ensures the financial system is sufficiently dynamic so that it can continue to allocate capital efficiently to support innovation and economic growth. The crisis revealed a number of significant weaknesses in the global financial system. First, many of the leading financial institutions at the core of the system did not have enough high-quality capital to be able to retain access to private funding markets in the face of large credit and mark-to-market losses. In particular, they often held grossly inadequate capital against their trading book exposures and the counterparty credit risk generated by activities such as their over-the-counter derivatives businesses. Second, individual firms and the system as a whole had inadequate liquidity buffers to withstand market-wide disruptions. Indeed, there was a widespread over-reliance on short-term funding to finance long-term illiquid assets. This was especially evident among the major securities dealers, which depended on tri-party repo funding to finance much of their securities inventories, and in the so-called shadow banking system, in which entities such as structured investment vehicles and conduits were dependent on short-term funding to finance their long-term assets. Banks that had provided liquidity guarantees to these shadow banks were in turn exposed when runs occurred on those entities. Third, a lack of transparency exacerbated uncertainty about the creditworthiness of many institutions. Some of this was due to the complexity of the assets. Collateralized debt obligations in particular were very hard to value, even in normal times. But some of this was also due to the lack of transparency about certain markets. The OTC derivatives market for credit default swaps is one notable example. Fourth, an inappropriate structure of incentives encouraged excessive risk-taking. This was evident within firms in the form of the so-called trader's option, in which compensation was mainly based on fiscal year results with no clawback when mark-to-market profits on illiquid securities and other assets subsequently turned into losses. It was also evident in the ability of the largest firms to benefit in terms of their funding costs by a perception that they would be too big to fail. Fifth, regulators and market participants did not appreciate how the financial system worked and was interconnected, so that shocks were transmitted broadly throughout the system, often intensifying as they spread rather than dampening. The severe economic costs generated by the crisis indicate that the primary goal must be to reduce the likelihood and severity of future financial crises. To accomplish this, we need a financial system that is better suited to withstand shocks of all kinds, regardless of their source. We need a financial system in which market participants face the appropriate set of incentives so they do not take excessive risks, but instead behave in ways that generate outcomes that are supportive to economic growth and ongoing financial stability. This requires that financial institutions have to internalize the cost of their risk-taking activities upfront and to hold capital and liquidity buffers that are sufficient to handle a plausible range of adverse outcomes. Finally, on occasions when these buffers do prove to be inadequate and a financial firm does reach the brink of failure, the official sector needs the capacity to smoothly wind down such firms so that future taxpayer rescues prove unnecessary. Regulatory and supervisory efforts to accomplish these goals are proceeding on several distinct but related paths. First, we're increasing the capital and liquidity standards for all internationally active banks, measured both by the quantity and quality of capital and liquidity, so that they are better able to absorb financial shocks without disrupting the flow of credit to the real economy. Second, we're introducing a credible resolution mechanism for managing the failure of a large systemic bank or non-bank financial institution in order to reduce the economy-wide costs of such failures, and by making those failures less disruptive, further reducing moral hazard by diminishing expectations of future public support. Third, we're ensuring that the largest and most interconnected financial institutions, whether or not they're chartered as banks, face even more stringent prudential standards. We're doing this in order to reduce moral hazard for the largest firms and to lower the probability of their failure to be below that of smaller and less systemically important institutions. Fourth, we're strengthening financial market infrastructure so that when failures that inevitably occur, the shocks generated by the failures will be dampened and are not amplified as they propagate through the financial system. And fifth, we're broadening the oversight of the financial system in order to identify sources of systemic risk that may emanate from non-bank financial firms or from other areas of activity. Now, turning first to the Basel III capital and liquidity standards agreed by the governors and heads of supervision in Basel last month, I believe these standards address some of the major shortcomings revealed by the crisis. In particular, the new standards will require banking organizations to significantly increase the amount of high-quality, loss-absorbing capital that they hold, significantly improve the risk capture in trading, counterparty credit, securitization, and other activities that the prior regulatory regime did not adequately capture, make it more expensive for banks to provide liquidity guarantees to shadow banks, constrain the leverage that banking companies can take by introducing credible, non-risk-based backstop, and finally, increase the capacity of banks to absorb shocks that might temporarily impede their ability to access short-term funding markets. Now, while the Basel Accord changes will only apply directly to large internationally active banks, they are going to have wider ramifications for the financial system as a whole, including non-banks and the capital markets. Furthermore, I believe that the agreement achieves an appropriate balance between significantly increasing the minimum capital and liquidity requirements for the major banks, while doing so in a way that recognizes the current state of the global economy and that seeks to minimize adjustment costs. The international regulatory community consciously has been willing to trade off a relatively slow phase-in period for the new standards in order to reach a much higher level of standards. In addition to the 4.5% minimum common equity standard agreed by the governors and heads of supervision, there's also a new conservation buffer requirement equal to 2.5% of risk-weighted assets. If a bank were to incur losses and fall deeper and deeper into this buffer, increasingly tough limitations would come into play in terms of that bank's ability to make capital distributions by paying out dividends or buying back shares. This capital conservation buffer is designed to forestall the type of behavior that we saw during the crisis. That is one in which banks continued to dissipate their capital by paying out dividends in order to try to demonstrate to market participants that they were strong. Instead, in the new regime, banks will have an incentive to raise additional equity so they can exit the buffer and its restrictions on their capital distributions. Now, in order to maintain operational flexibility in terms of their business operations and an ongoing ability to distribute capital to their shareholders, we expect banks will want to maintain their level of tangible common equity at or above 7%. That's the sum of the minimum requirement and the conservation buffer. That said, we do anticipate that the buffer may be penetrated from time to time during adverse economic environments, so that's anticipated. Finally, the risk-based standards will be backstopped by a new leverage ratio standard. This is going to constrain the overall amount of leverage that a banking organization can take relative to the sum of its non-risk-weighted assets and off-balance sheet exposures. Together, these changes represent a very significant upgrade from what we had in place before. A much higher proportion of the ratio is now met by common equity. That common equity is much better quality than before. The amount of risk-weighted assets against which capital must be held has increased and better reflects the underlying risks. A new capital conservation buffer has been added, and there's a new backstop against excessive leverage. So what were the considerations that went into constructing this new standard? Well, I think the basic goal was to enable the big internationally active banks covered by the Basel Accord to absorb the type of losses associated with a major market-wide financial shock and still retain sufficient market confidence so they could continue to be able to fund themselves and, if necessary, to raise additional equity without the need for unusual government support. I believe that the requirements were the outgrowth of at least four major considerations. First, what type of losses could banks expect to incur in a crisis? In other words, how thick a buffer was needed to absorb losses? This is represented by the 2.5% capital conservation buffer. Although this is not thick enough to protect every bank in every crisis, it does create a loss-absorbing cushion so that banks will be able to retain their ability to access the capital markets even after they incur significant losses. Second, how much common equity must a bank hold to be viewed as viable by financial market participants? This is important because beyond a certain point, banks lose their access to the capital markets, and this makes failure much more likely. The 4.5% minimum common equity requirement is set at a high enough level so that a bank operating above this level would very likely still be able to access the capital markets in order to replenish its capital base after large losses. Third, what was achievable internationally? It is important to have international convergence in terms of standards. This is necessary to minimize competitive inequity and to avoid creating incentives for a race to the bottom. If standards differed markedly around the world, then the conversation would inevitably shift to what will help my banks competitively from what levels of capital do we need to have a sound financial system? Fourth, what is the appropriate trade-off between benefits and costs? There are diminishing returns in terms of benefits of ever higher capital requirements. Setting the bar at too high a level would increase intermediation costs too much and drive activities offshore or into areas that are not as closely regulated. At some point, higher requirements would not make the financial system safer, just the regulated sector much smaller. On this last point, some argue that the new standards are too severe. They argue that in the short run, the higher standards could lead to a significant constraint in credit that could hurt the nation's economic expansion. And they argue in the long run that the higher capital standards will inevitably drive up lending costs, and that will hurt economic performance. Although I believe that the new standards do impose some real cost on the financial system in order to achieve real benefits, I believe that these concerns over costs are exaggerated. Turning first to the issue of the transition to the new regime, we cannot precisely predict the size of adjustment costs because they're going to depend importantly on the strategies that bank managers employ to meet the new requirements and how bank investors respond to these actions. Nonetheless, I think the transition is likely to be quite manageable for three reasons. First, many of the large U.S. banks already have large amounts of tangible common equity. In part, this represents the regulatory response to the crisis. During the Supervisory Capital Assessment Program, or SCAP, in 2009, required the large banks to have capital buffer consistent with achieving a Tier 1 common ratio of 4% under a stress environment that was considerably worse than what was anticipated or what did in fact occur. Banks that fell short of this were forced to raise additional capital. On top of this, the repayment terms for TARP provided strong incentives for banks to issue common equity to repay the TARP preferred stock. In addition, several banks converted preferred stock into common equity. So at the end of the day, roughly speaking, the 19 banks that were subject to the SCAP generated more than $100 billion of common equity via share issuance and $80 billion by conversion of preferred stock into common equity in 2009. Second, as noted earlier, the standards are being phased in slowly. For example, in 2013, so that's 3 years from now, the tangible common equity standard will be only 3.5%. In 2013, there will be no conservation buffer requirement, and banks will still get credit for items that will ultimately be deducted from common equity, such as deferred tax assets. The Federal Reserve is the consolidated supervisor of the largest and most complex banking companies. It does not expect these banks to meet the fully phased-in requirements today. Instead, the Federal Reserve will require firms to develop an adequate capital plan to meet the Basel III requirements as they become effective, and will track their progress towards meeting these plans over time. Third, banks have many ways they can adjust their business models to meet the new standards as they're phased in. Many of these changes can occur without any risk of disruption of the flow of credit to households and businesses. For instance, banks can sell non-strategic assets to investors, and they can modify their minority interest in non-consolidated enterprises. Low-quality legacy assets, such as subprime mortgage loans and second mortgages, will mature and run off. Risk-weighted assets will tend to fall as the economy recovers. Moreover, as banks book profits, deferred tax assets will shrink, reducing the magnitude of these future deductions from common equity. Finally, it's important to note the significant potential earnings power of the large U.S. banks, which have historically tended to earn higher rates of return on their average assets relative to their foreign counterparts. Banks that are currently short of the 2019 standard could retain these earnings to build up their capital ratios. Equity analysts project that the 20 largest U.S. banks will earn more than $80 billion in 2010, and consensus estimates expect that figure will increase to around $110 billion in 2011. Of course, because these estimates are dependent on an economy that continues to recover, we need to be cautious about relying entirely on as yet unrealized earnings as a primary means to meet the higher capital standards. So what about the long-run consequences? It would be prudent to assume that requiring banks to hold more capital and higher cost capital is likely to result in somewhat higher lending margins. Bank managements will need to generate sufficient income to support a rate of return on equity that's at a sufficiently high level so that banks can continue to attract capital from investors. That said, what's critical is whether the increase in lending spreads is likely to be large or not. Those who argue that the new capital standards will necessitate a large increase in lending spreads generally start with a rigid set of assumptions. These include, first, the return on bank equity is unchanged. Second, the increase in bank equity does not affect funding costs. Third, there is no change in the bank's book of business or in bank's ability and willingness to adjust other expenses, such as compensation. I believe that such rigid assumptions are unrealistic. And this is particularly important because each assumption is likely to be wrong precisely in the direction that reduces the impact on lending margins. First, the necessary return on equity that banks will have to generate to be able to attract capital will likely fall. Because banks will have more capital, they should be safer. Their earnings should be less volatile. Investors should therefore demand a lower return on equity than before. Second, by increasing the soundness of banks and an increase in bank equity, everything else equal, should also reduce funding costs. Third, higher bank lending spreads will almost certainly push some activity into the capital markets, and this will constrain the magnitude of the rise in total lending margins. Finally, banks may be forced via competitive pressures to lower their compensation levels. By cutting compensation costs, banks could have smaller lending margins and still earn sufficient profits to generate the level of returns necessary to continue to be able to attract capital. Given all the potential margins for adjustment, there are good reasons to expect that the increase in lending margins will actually turn out to be quite modest. Of course, although any increase will be a real cost, this appears to me to be a necessary and appropriate price to pay for a much more resilient financial system. Recent years have certainly taught us that easy access to credit that is underpriced because it's not backed by sufficient capital is not a sustainable route to prosperity. Indeed, to the extent that the tougher standards reduce the misallocation of resources in the real economy that often accompanies periods of financial excess, ensures more consistent access to finance over time, and encourages investment by holding out the prospect of greater economic stability, it's certainly possible that the new standards will be consistent with higher sustainable growth rate over the long run. Turning next to the new Basel liquidity requirement, this new standard will likely necessitate a significant adjustment in behavior for those banks that historically have relied on short-term wholesale funding and those that had negligible buffers but instead had relied on the Federal Reserve and the Federal Home Loan Bank System for their liquidity backstops. However, the transition costs here are likely to be quite manageable because, as was the case for the capital standards, there are many margins available for adjustment. Before I assess the transition costs of the liquidity coverage ratio standard, a few words about what this standard is intended to do and how it operates. The notion behind the liquidity coverage ratio, or LCR standard, is that large internationally active banks should have a liquidity buffer that enables them to operate for 30 days in a stressed environment without having to rely on government support, including central bank liquidity backstops. Banks would need to have sufficient liquid assets that they could sell in order to meet outflows stemming from deposit withdrawals, bank debt that matures and that's unable to be rolled over, and drawdowns from committed credit and liquidity facilities that the bank has provided to other financial firms and other entities. The size of the required liquidity buffer, of course, depends in part on the maturity of the bank's assets and liabilities, the stickiness of its deposit liabilities, the amount of irrevocable liquidity backstops, and the composition of the bank's assets. The adjustment costs associated with the LCR standard should be low because, like capital, there are different and relatively low-cost ways to adjust to the new standards. For example, because the liquidity buffer only needs to last 30 days, a bank that extends the maturity of its short-term wholesale funding or its deposit liabilities by just a month or two will find that this goes a long way in helping to meet the standard. Banks could also cut the level of their backstop liquidity lines and other commitments to financial firms. The standard assumes that such lines of credit can be fully drawn on and thus count as potential draws against the buffer. Because the common international liquidity standards are relatively untested, regulators are implementing the LCR with what's called an observation period. What this means is that unanticipated and unintended consequences generated by this new liquidity standard will be closely scrutinized, and if necessary, adjustments will be made to the rules if undesirable effects become evident over time. For example, the tough standards on backstop liquidity lines could potentially be modified if such rules generated unintended negative consequences for short-term corporate funding markets, such as the non-financial corporate commercial paper market. Moving on from changes to capital and liquidity standards, I now want to discuss something different, how firms, markets, and the official sector deal with distress in the event that it were to occur. Of paramount importance in this regard is making the financial system more robust is a need for a viable resolution mechanism for large, complex financial firms. The Dodd-Frank Act does this for the non-bank operations of systemically important U.S. financial institutions by authorizing the FDIC, under certain conditions, to establish a bridge bank to liquidate the troubled firm's operations in an orderly manner. Any net outlays incurred by the FDIC in this process must be recovered by assessing levies on the financial industry. This resolution process is beneficial because an orderly resolution prevents the type of catastrophic collapse that leads to widespread market disruption. And it does so in a way that the taxpayer funds are not at risk. However, much work needs to be done so that the market participants can understand how such resolutions would work in practice. In particular, there will be some uncertainty about the precise conditions that will trigger a resolution under the Dodd-Frank Act. Even with the Dodd-Frank Act, the alternative of a normal bankruptcy code filing remains in play. In fact, the Dodd-Frank Act requires an evaluation of why a filing under the bankruptcy code is not appropriate. In addition, the Dodd-Frank resolution process is complex, having multiple steps. Moreover, the Dodd-Frank resolution regime could be very difficult to implement for complex, globally active firms. These firms operate in diverse legal regimes worldwide, and it's very doubtful that the Dodd-Frank Act will apply to these banks' operations outside the United States. Now, one approach to this problem would be to harmonize the diverse insolvency laws in the various jurisdictions in which globally active firms have significant operations. But unfortunately, I think achieving this objective will be hard and take many years at a minimum. This is one reason to require additional loss-absorbing capacity for systemically important firms, most, if not all, which tend to be complex global organizations. Such a surcharge would be a mechanism to reduce the probability of failure for such firms below that of smaller firms. A surcharge for systemically important financial institutions has two motivations. First, it compensates for the distortion created by the fact that a large financial firm may still be resolved differently in the future than smaller firms. This could conceivably, by being an orderly resolution process, reduce the cost imposed upon creditors. To the extent that creditors see this as a benefit, this might enable large banks to retain some funding advantage over smaller banks that are not likely to be resolved in the same fashion. Second, it recognizes the large cost imposed on the broader financial system by the failure of systemically important banks. Such approach is being pursued both internationally and in the United States. The recent governors and heads of supervision meeting in Basel, for example, endorsed additional loss-absorbing capacity for systemically important firms. Similarly, the Dodd-Frank Act provides that the Federal Reserve shall establish prudential standards for systemically important financial institutions, including capital and liquidity standards that are, quote, more stringent, unquote, than for other institutions that do not present systemic risk. Strengthening financial market infrastructures is another important initiative underway to make the financial system more resilient and robust. In this regard, there are two important strands of work underway. First, there's strong momentum both in the United States and abroad to require that standardized OTC derivatives products be cleared through central counterparties, or CCPs, and that the information associated with all OTC derivatives trades be reported to trade repositories, with this information being made available to regulators around the world. Second, the Committee on Payment and Settlement Systems, the CPSS, and the International Organization of Securities Commission, IOSCO, are undertaking a review of international standards for financial market infrastructures. This review will lead to a comprehensive set of recommendations as to what constitutes best practice with respect to the operations of financial market infrastructures. These recommendations will apply to a broad array of FMIs, including CCPs and trade repositories. The final report will be completed during the first half of 2011. The goal here will be to have these standards endorsed by the Financial Stability Board and by the G20 leaders. With these endorsements, it should be possible to harden these recommendations and turn them into more substantial standards. In all the reforms that we are implementing, I think it's also important that we pay close attention to what's happening in the so-called shadow banking system. By shadow banks, I mean the largely unregulated financial entities that take credit risk or engage in maturity transformation without access to explicit government backstops, such as the Federal Reserve's discount window or deposit insurance. As we saw in the crisis, without such support, these institutions are vulnerable to runs. And when this occurred, the shadow banking system imploded in a way that imposed very significant cost on the regulated sector. The risk is that tighter capital and liquidity requirements for large financial institutions could push some of the business of credit intermediation and maturity transformation out of the regulated sector into the unregulated sector. However, I think this risk is mitigated by the fact that shadow banks often heavily rely on credit support and liquidity lines from the regulated sector. The costs of such facilities will be affected by the new capital and liquidity standards that are being imposed on banks. Thus, the economics of the shadow banking sector are likely to change in a way that makes these activities less attractive. In addition, by increasing transparency and requiring some risk retention by issuers, the Dodd-Frank Act should make securitization markets in which shadow banks operate less likely to support poorly underwritten credit. Taken together, these changes mean it is less likely that there will be widespread movement of credit and maturity transformation out of the regulated sector into the unregulated sector. Nonetheless, as my colleague Governor Tarillo noted in a recent speech, more will need to be done to increase the stability of the unregulated sectors, and developments in this area will need to be carefully scrutinized in the years ahead. Before closing, let me reiterate how important it is to achieve harmonize global standards. As I noted earlier, this is important for competitive equity reasons. But more importantly, I think it's necessary to ensure that banks and other financial firms cannot move their activities to evade regulation. If that were to occur, we would just have a race to the bottom and a less transparent and even more complicated financial system. In this respect, it's important that we regulate the U.S. operations of foreign banks in a way that is consistent with how U.S. banks are treated. It is also important that we work for the same type of national treatment abroad. And when there are differences in regulatory regimes, that we find ways of reducing or eliminating substantial differences over time. Finally, it's important that we clarify the responsibilities of the home and host countries and work to share information across the regulatory community. This can help ensure that regulatory decisions are made and applied in a consistent and fair manner. It's also my hope that by establishing a robust global regime, we can mitigate the incentives for national regulators and supervisors to impose local rules that make it hard for globally active firms to manage their operations on a global basis. Such global operations support the global integration of markets and economic globalization and the benefits that stem from them. Over the next 12 to 18 months, the regulators are going to be particularly busy in implementing these reform efforts. Broad legal statutes now have to be turned into specific rules and regulations governing business practices, conduct, and operations. Doing this well, in particular, in a way that's sufficiently informed, deep, and broad, will be very, very important. Basel III and the Dodd-Frank Act they're important markers on the road, but it's always important to understand that this is a journey to a never-reached destination of regulatory perfection. Thank you for your kind attention. I'd be happy to take a few questions.
Thank you, Bill, for that very thorough and comprehensive review of the Basel Accord, and I particularly appreciated your reassurance on the importance of harmonization, which I think is so fundamental for the very reasons that you outlined. I know your schedule is pressed, but we appreciate your willingness to take questions. And our chief economist here, I think, has perhaps the first one.
Bill, excellent summary of what's going on and why it's going on. Quick question, which sort of puts both of your hats on, both as a Uber regulator and also as a monetary policymaker. I mean, it seems to me you're scratching your head a little bit as a monetary policymaker, trying to understand why the economy is having a hard time gaining traction and in particular creating jobs in an environment where it sort of should be given your monetary policy stance. And I wonder if you have sort of reflections based on the potential for the effects of not so much tougher regulation, because as you say, that's not yet really in force, but the actual tougher behavior that the markets are kind of forcing on banks in the United States. Banks have clearly adjusted very rapidly, primarily, to be honest, under market pressure, I think also the SCAP, but certainly market pressure. And I wonder if you feel that there's any sort of relationship there. And I, in particular, as a sort of well-versed US economist, I wonder if you kind of see any parallels here to what was happening in the early 90s when the economy was last trying to struggle to come out of a banking problem.
Well, I think there's no question that the problems in the banking sector did at one point lead to a significant tightening of credit standards and credit availability. Some of that was appropriate because the credit standards were set at a level going into the crisis that were inappropriately easy. I think the good news, though, is that the tightening of credit standards actually has passed. If you look at the Federal Reserve survey of senior loan officers, no banks are tightening their credit standards today, and in fact, some banks are actually starting to loosen their credit standards. So I think that's a factor that's affecting the economy, but I think that we're past that worst point. And I would expect as time passes, we'll see a further improvement in credit availability. And as that happens, that will actually help support economic activity going forward.
From our new vice chairman.
Thank you very much. I'd just like to reinforce a great speech and well communicated, and an important speech because we have to hear more from the senior regulators and how you're thinking and where we're going. In your speech, two things caught my attention, which I'd like to ask you on. I think your points on shadow banking are very, very important as we look forward. I'm not sure I agree with your confidence that this indirect way of getting to them is going to solve the issue, because we're moving on the deleveraging a lot over that market. But you did say, and then maybe this is my first question, I'm going to have a second one here, is that through the Basel and the other regulations that this will have an effect, and regardless whether you're a chartered bank or not. And I didn't quite, again, I'm not in the United States, but quite what that really means is that some attempt to get at the shadow banking. And my second question, unrelated but very important, and that's what the investor thinks. And do you think there is a risk that despite the great length of time that it's going to take, the regulators are allowing to 2019, that the market will disregard that and punish those banks today that are not going to meet those standards, and then also that particularly those will be the weaker banks?
Okay. Let me take the second question first. As I said in my remarks, we are not enforcing the 2019 standards today, and we do not expect the banks to meet those standards today. We expect the banks to come up with capital plans that show how they'll be able to meet those standards over time. And I would think that the market would be very accepting of that strategy. The fact that the U.S. banks can earn large amounts of money over that long transition period, I think, is very, very helpful, and that should provide quite a bit of reassurance that the banks in the U.S. at least should be able to meet the final standards in 2019 without a great deal of difficulty. The other thing, I think it's very important to understand that banks are going to change their business models. They're going to change in reaction to the new standards, and that's going to generate a lot more room in terms of their ability to meet the final 2019 standards. Now, in terms of the shadow banking system, I think that what's really important here is to recognize that the regulatory oversight process is not going to be just constrained to the banking sector. The Systemic Oversight Council in the United States, for example, is going to be looking at for systemic risk regardless of where they might arise. And I think that this crisis has basically really underscored the importance of financial stability in the monetary policy setting process so that, I think people are going to be looking at the financial system horizontally, not just in terms of vertical slices. You know, one of the things I think that was a weakness historically was people regulated individual groups of firms and didn't fully appreciate the consequences of their interconnectedness. We certainly now know in spades how important that is. And so, I can assure you from my seat as the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York that we're going to be looking at the financial system broadly, not just banks, but also what happens in the shadow banking system.
Bill, we are very indebted for your presence here this morning. We've actually learned quite a lot, and we look forward to continuing to have the opportunity to work with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Charles.